You're listening to The Bulletin with UBS, first broadcast on the 15th of November 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24. Each week we'll be hearing from the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance, taking you beyond the numbers and the hype and getting to the heart of the big issues of the day. This week we're looking at potential re-emerging markets, asking whether there are signs that the underperforming EM sector might rebound. And if so, what are the prospects of a return to the glory days of the early 2000s? We'll consider some of the structural concerns that run through the sector and ask what role new technologies might play. Finally, we'll ask our experts who will be the winners and losers in the EM space. We start in Zurich with Michael Bolliger, who heads the Emerging Market Asset Allocation Team at the UBS CIO. Are there signs of a bottom in the underperforming emerging markets? Watch out for a pickup in commodity prices, says Michael.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of drivers or indicators that could point toward EM asset prices bottoming out. What has driven the performance in the last couple of weeks is clearly some stabilization and a bit of a pickup in commodity prices, most notably energy, which has been very important for some of the most troubled EM countries, including wide parts of Latin America, also some of the weaker names in EMEA. The second thing is that despite, a growing likelihood of a Fed rate hike in December, other major central banks continue to ease monetary policy conditions, and that's most notably ECB, the European Central Bank, but also People's Bank of China, India, Qatar, and then a range of smaller central banks as well. And then last, but probably most importantly, we see tentative signs of an economic stabilization. This is first and foremost in Asia, where we see, for example, PMI manufacturing indicators trending sideways rather than falling as they have over the last couple of months. So, adding all these things together, in addition to, very bearish market sentiment, very bearish positioning, several quarters of underperformance, EM assets rallied quite a bit in October.
Jorge Mariscal is UBS Chief Investment Officer for the Emerging Markets. What's his take?
There are signs of a bottom in their economies. The markets have been somewhat volatile. They rallied in October, been selling off in November. The signs of the economic bottoming out include a more stable set of numbers in China, industrial production, manufacturing price indices, housing, consumer sales. We're also witnessing some better numbers in other places like Russia, Turkey, and Mexico. So there appears to be not quite a strong economic rebound, but more signs of stability.
As yet, there are no solid signs of a rebound in emerging markets. That's according to Bob Swarup, financial commentator and investor and author of Money Mania.
I think it's probably a bit premature to say we're bottoming out. I think the situation has stabilized. But my suspicion is that if the Fed raises rates in December, then that may well start another round of agitation in emerging markets. Because don't forget, there's something like $2.6 trillion of emerging market debt out there, of which a lot of it is in US dollars, particularly the stuff that was written in recent years. So those people have an enormous problem because of the dollar strengthening anyway. That's partly what's caused a lot of stresses at their end. If the US starts to raise rates, well, as you can imagine, the market will probably assume the US is not going to just stop at one rate rise. It'll probably now start pricing in two or three more, which means that for any emerging market, that suddenly means the amount they have to pay out compared to their local currency will go up. So that will cause more problems.
Banu Baweja heads EM cross-asset strategy for the UBS Investment Bank. Does he think the sector could be bottoming out?
No, I don't. It's been a long ride. Emerging market equities, for instance, have underperformed developed market equities by 60% cumulative over the last 5 years. And the last time this happened, between 1997 and 2001, it really was time to buy emerging markets. But what's different this time is that global balance sheets have already expanded. China has levered up tremendously, and there's significant excess capacity, not just in the Chinese real estate market, but elsewhere as well, which will mean that it's difficult for EM earnings to pick up. So I'm afraid it's not same old. I don't think EM has reached a level of competitiveness where they can start gaining market share and boost earnings and growth. So I don't think it's time to buy. I think we've got more wood to chop.
Given this pretty mixed view of the short and medium-term prospects, when, if ever, might we get back to the glory days of the early 2000s? There is far too much uncertainty in the short term for that to happen anytime soon, explains Michael Bolliger.
I think that's a very long way. I mean, I wouldn't rule it out, but it's a very long and uncertain way. So here, clearly, from the way we look at things, is we clearly distinguish between a cyclical rebound, which is what we see now and which for us as investors provides opportunities to take selective exposure. And then, you know, the other thing we monitor or we analyze is the structural trends. And the structural trends are clearly around two major things in my view. The first one is that over the last 10 or 15 years, there were several EM countries which had growth models that were severely linked to ever-declining costs of credit. So this credit-fueled growth in an environment where maybe, you know, you can assume that global interest rates would start to trend sideways, if not higher, obviously this credit-fueled growth model is no longer working. That's the first thing, and that would then mean that, you know, some of these countries have to come up with a new growth model, which is a longer-term structural thing for change, and that's not so easy to accomplish within a couple of months. The other thing is with regard to China, and China has made significant contribution to growth in the emerging markets, especially via its investment-led growth, which has had positive implications, for example, demand for commodities to other emerging markets in Latin America, for example. And this is most likely also over as China will drive away from an investment-led growth model to a consumption-led growth model. There will be more demand for services, which mainly come from the developed world, and there will be less demand for commodities, for example.
Jorge Mariscal is sanguine about the prospects of a return to anything resembling these so-called glory days.
Those are probably days that will not come back anytime soon. The outlook for global growth is somewhat muted. One of the consequences of global rebalancing is that, you know, the rich countries are now saving more and consuming less, and the developing countries are forced to rely more on domestic sources of growth rather than exports. They face a low commodity price environment. Overall, the equilibrium growth rate for the world is much lower in this rebalancing world. That means that the rates of economic activity in the emerging world are also challenged. Countries that are doing better are those that are able to imbue their economies with structural reforms that increase their productivity, and those who rely on their domestic markets. But that's not an easy thing to do in even a few years. It takes a long time to refocus their economy. So I'm afraid that we're probably headed for a more moderate pace of growth, not only in the rest of the world, but also in the emerging markets in the next 5 years.
Does Bob Swarup think we can get back there?
Bear in mind that an emerging market, by definition, is one that is very much in its infancy. I mean, China, for example, for all of its volatility, and India and others, are really no different to what, say, the US and Argentina were like in the 19th century. In other words, huge booms, huge busts, but yet another big boom. You know, China, whatever else, you know, I think no one can deny that they are now a global superpower. Certainly in terms of the size of the economy, you know, on a purchasing power basis, they're larger than the US, which is remarkable. I mean, that's the first time the US has been dethroned in a very, very long time, over a century. And in, you know, in actual GDP terms, they're second. So, you know, you can't walk away from that, and they're clearly starting now to flex their muscles. And one would argue that, in fact, probably the next phase of China's development, besides trying to kind of encourage consumption, is a greater focus on kind of neo-mercantilism, you know, state capitalism. And you can see that the way, for example, when they came over to the UK, I mean, they were definitely showing off the economic might and using it to try and get deals done that worked for them.
What are the prospects of a return to anything resembling the early 2000s then? Here's Banu Bawaja's view.
Let's just put in context what has happened through the last decade and a half, right? You saw a combination of extremely strong trade growth relative to GDP growth globally. You saw declining real interest rates globally, and you saw the rise of Chinese real estate, which was the most commodity-thirsty sector in the world. All three of these played to EM strengths, and all three of these therefore led to very strong EM growth and also very strong EM asset prices. All of these factors have now reached a fairly mature stage and are now, if anything, in reverse. So I don't think that we will see EM going through that boom in the next 5 to 7 years. Emerging markets will have to work very hard and will have to reform. Unfortunately, you know, in my book, the god of reform is the US Treasury market, and as yet it is not an angry god because of QE. So we are in this strange sort of muddle through stage, the swampland of muddled through, as we like to call it, where you have very weak growth prospects, but you don't have the trigger point for a major catharsis, and the trigger point, as I implied earlier, is usually much higher real interest rates in the U.S. So I'm afraid we're going to see a growth lull in emerging markets for the foreseeable future. Perhaps not a major crisis, but nonetheless very lackluster returns.
Still to come on the Bulletin with UBS, we'll look at some of the underlying structural concerns here, and we'll ponder who the eventual winners and losers in the EM space might be. Let's turn next to some of the structural concerns in this space. The critical issue is shifting from a reliance on exports to a model driven more by domestic consumption, explains Jorge Mariscal.
The name of the game is to rely more on domestic consumption and less on exports. And to do that, there has to be a better sentiment in the nascent middle class that you have in many of the emerging markets, more reliance on their own technology, as you said, their own sources of growth, and less on the traditional exports. So the new economy in the emerging markets, retailing, e-tailing, healthcare, pharmaceuticals in general, look more promising than the traditional commodities-oriented sectors, industrial sectors, and so on and so forth. And so, you know, unleashing the market forces within each of these economies in the emerging world, including China, is the key to growth. And so there, some countries are doing it better than others. China has made some good progress on structural reform, but much more needs to be done.
What's Michael Bolliger's reading of the structural issues?
A bigger issue here is, you know, that, for example, if you look at China specifically, this, you know, growth model of the last 10-15 years was to a significant extent also geared toward manufacturing, heavy industries, and all these things, right? And, you know, if you look, for example, if you do a decomposition of purchasing price inflation in China, you see that it's especially these industries that have significant overcapacities. So that means that there will be more pressure on these sort of old EM growth models, whereas there will be more demand for new technologies and new services, right? So that includes technologies on the one hand, but also services like insurance or health, etc. You know, you have to keep in mind that China is an $11 trillion economy, so it's the second biggest economy globally. And so if the Chinese want more insurance, that has positive implications, obviously, for some of these insurance companies in China, but also elsewhere. Typically, as I said, right, this is more beneficial for DM, and it's maybe less beneficial for the emerging markets.
And what about new technologies? We asked Banu Baweja how important this might become.
It's a crucial question, because there's a part of emerging markets, in fact, the large part of emerging markets, when you think about it in terms of populations, whose real strength is unskilled labor, masses of unskilled labor. And if we see sort of a third or fourth industrial revolution, depending on which one you call your first, and the need for unskilled labor is substituted by technology, then that will, more than anything else, create political and social pressures in those economies. And many economies have skipped the stage of industrialization and have moved towards services or towards commodities from agriculture, South Africa and India spring to mind. And these are the kind of economies that hold a lot of promise if we can employ labor in those economies, but in fact their prospects would be seriously compromised if you can't. And if technologies are such that they compromise employment for unskilled labor, then these economies will have to reform much quicker than they're presently doing. Otherwise, there will be social and political pressure. So I think some parts of EM will gain, obviously, the ones that have invested in research and development, Korea, China, Taiwan, large parts of Northeast Asia, which have seen very strong growth in the 1960s onwards, the 1980s. But the others, which are just about emerging right now, could be emerging for a while yet.
Looking ahead then, through and beyond the current uncertainty, which countries might emerge as the winners? Or is the picture, as already suggested, far more complex than that? Michael Bolliger shares his views on the shifting global picture.
I would strongly distinguish between the horizon. You want to look at the winners and losers, right? So in the short term, we think, you know, Asia looks a bit better. Several markets there, they look, you know, promising. We've seen Korean markets starting to show outperformance, Taiwan starting to show outperformance. Also, as I said, China stabilizing. So there is some signs of improvement there. whereas, you know, for example, Brazil, etc., they're still struggling with current issues. Also, near term, I'd say Central and Eastern Europe, they are still nicely positioned to benefit from ease monetary policy conditions in Europe, but also from a relatively robust recovery in the Eurozone.
And what about in the longer term?
Over the longer term, I think it will be very difficult. And we think India looks very good on a longer term basis. So this is a market we like structurally, maybe the Philippines as well. And then in the rest of Latin America and EMEA, it will depend strongly to what extent these markets are willing to also do, you know, some more painful adjustments, to do some reforms. You know, looking at Brazil, for example, there is a lot of talk about this, but no action. So until the Brazilians become ready to, you know, do these changes that can be painful in the near term, Brazil will likely suffer more. South Africa, for example, hasn't addressed any of its structural issues. So likely South Africa will continue to underperform for longer.
Jorge Mariscal, too, is optimistic about the potential of both Mexico and India, at least.
Well, India is one. We think that India has a pretty good momentum in terms of structural reform. They find themselves at a very low per capita income level relative to other developing countries, so much room to catch up, lacking a lot of infrastructure, despite the fact that they have a fairly advanced IT sector and a healthcare sector. The bulk of the country still is fairly underdeveloped, so much room for investment, infrastructure development, growth. So that's one. On the non-Asia side of the world, Mexico is a long-term bet. It's promising. They also engage in aggressive structural reform of their educational sector, the telecommunications sector, the banking industry, and more recently, the energy sector. As a long-term proposition, maybe not immediately, but the long-term Mexico and India look promising to us.
And that's Jorge Mariscal bringing us to the end of this 58th edition of the Bulletin with UBS, setting the agenda in the fast-moving world of finance every week here on Monocle 24. In a couple of weeks' time, on the 1st of December, UBS will be releasing its 2016 and beyond, an outlook for economies, markets, and portfolio positioning for the year and years ahead. Head to ubs.com/houseview and register for a preview and more. In the meantime, you can listen again to this show and browse the archive at monocle.com via iTunes or SoundCloud. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.